copies on the desk here of Brother Benson's speech on the Book of Mormon. You should all pick one up when you go out. And we're on the 46th chapter of Alma. And I repeat, I said it before and I say it again, if this was all we had, if this is all Joseph Smith ever left us, it would be very powerful evidence to his being a true prophet. It starts out on a theme that's become painfully obvious today, namely, remember, we begin with the end of the preceding chapter, a coalition of protesters, an action group. They feel their wealth is threatened, and they are going to undertake desperate measures. And so, who were they? Well, we can find out who this group were in Alma 45 in the preceding chapter, verses 23 and 24. We mentioned that, who they were. Came to pass, they happened priests and teachers over the churches. There arose dissensions among them. They would not give heed to the words of Helaman. They grew proud because of their exceeding great riches. Therefore, they grew rich in their own eyes. And then if we go to the fourth and fifth verses of this chapter, they were those Malachi desired to be king, and those who supported him were in greater part lower judges of the land, and they were seeking for power, upwardly mobile career people here. And we have also in the fifth verse, he promised to make them rulers. He promised career. You're going to have a spoil system. When I get in, you'll all have better jobs. So he has a backing here, and he's very skillful in manipulating it. Then the 51st chapter, we also have reference to who comprised this particular support group he had. It wasn't strong enough to hold on, as you soon find out. But in the 51st chapter, in the 8th verse, it tells us here. Now, those who are in favor of kings who are of high birth. Those also, you see, as you might imagine, who sought to be kings, and they were supported by those who sought power and authority over the people. Ambition all over the place is the point. All the ambitious, the rich, the upward, the mobile people, notice, so of high birth, the snobs and all the rest of it, by those who sought power and authority over the people. And then in the 17th verse of the same chapter, it came to pass his army to go against the king to pull down their pride and their nobility. And then in the 21st verse, when I put an end to those king men, their stubbornness and their pride, those people who professed the blood of nobility. They were brought down to be humble and so on. So we get a very good idea what kind of a coalition this was. I mean, it's a typical Near Eastern, Central American, you name it. Anywhere you get this combination, this typical type of the landowners, the powerful group that gets together and wants to rule the land as against a popular leader leading a popular cause here. And we read in the 7th verse here that many in the church believed in the flattering words of Amalickiah. They were taken in because they're more impressed by political and economic arguments, people always are, than winning over in religion. And so as a result, you can see they just got through a hard war, and the affairs of the people of Nephi were exceedingly precarious. They were exhausted after the war. They're split down the center now, and this is the last thing in the world that Moroni wanted, of course. Moroni wasn't the head of the church, Alma was, but... And thus, he contemplates, we mentioned this before, we see how quick these things happen. The wisdom literature, 8th and 9th verses belong to what you call wisdom literature. It was very characteristic in Lehi's day. Great deal of studies, more studies being made on wisdom literature than any other field today. And it has to do with the common ground of the Egyptian and Hebrew wisdom literature. The wisdom of Solomon is found in the wisdom of Amenemhat, word for word, you see. The wisdom literature of the Jews and the wisdom literature of the Hebrews is like that. Nobody was willing to admit it till very recently because it looked, well, you're very suspicious when you find the Bible in Egyptian writings, but there it is. And they finally broken down and admitted that the wisdom literature of the Jews and other literature, studies by Fox and many others on this particular subject showing that the wisdom literature of the two is the same. Way back it was discovered. Ehrman discovered it ages ago. And a very important work, the Tomb of Petosiris, was studied by a Frenchman who found at least 20 passages from the Old Testament in the tomb. And this was a great priest. This is a high priest, a very important priest. A very important tomb from the 5th century B.C. during the Persian period. What's he doing quoting the Old Testament all over the place? Come with me, and I will teach you the way of salvation, the way of light and truth. And he goes on in that manner, Petosiris says. And so Lefebvre, who edited the text, got it all together, says, it's pure coincidence that there are at least 20 passages identical from the Old Testament and the teachings of Petosiris And lo and behold, it's just a coincidence. They had nothing to do with each other. Can you imagine that? Well, finally, they've broken down a bit. Yes, it must be the same. It's not surprising the Book of Mormon is written in Egyptian. It's a much more concise and easy to handle. They tell us. If we could write in Hebrew, yes, but the place would be too large then. It takes up too much space. But at this time, Demotic writing was the official writing in Hebrew. It had only been in for 100 years, but it was a new shorthand, and everybody was using it because it was very, very convenient. It was so much shorter than anything else discovered. There is in the 32nd room of the Cairo Museum, if you remember, 35th or 32nd? It's the 35th, I think. 32nd is where you find the hypocephalon. Well, anyway, there's an inscription. Oh, I should have brought along pictures of it. An inscription in Greek and in Egyptian and in Demotic, the three, Egyptian Demotic writing and Egyptian hieroglyphic writing and in Greek. The Greek takes up so much space, the Egyptian takes up so much space, and the hieratic, not hieratic, but the Demotic takes up just about seven lines. For all the other inscriptions take up half a wall, but this one just like that. It's amazingly economical. So that's probably why they were using it. Well, they explained that's why they were using it. We could write in Hebrew, it'd be more understood, but still. And so we have this wisdom literature. Then we go on to the 10th verse, and we talk about the tricks here. Amalickiah, cunning, the flattering words, that's the secret. All through the Book of Mormon, you see that's what does it. Public relations do the thing. As Joseph Smith says, the devil is an orator. He flatters them. He tells them the things they want to hear. Samuel the Naamanite says, when someone comes and tells you what's wrong about Zarahemla, you stone him, cast him out, and say he's a false prophet. If he tells you what's right about Zarahemla, you carry him on your shoulders and dress him in costly attire and parade him around the city. It's a very interesting document from the Chilambalam, the Mayan document. It says, when a true prophet came among the people, they would lift him up and carry him on their shoulders through the city, exactly as it says in the Book of Mormon. When he says, when a prophet comes and false prophet tells you what good people you are, then you say he's a true prophet and you raise him up and dress him in fine apparel, carry him around the city. So we have these things, but this 46th chapter, it's just loaded with these things that are just casually tossed in, little things that you'd have no control over. A German scholar wrote a massive work on documentary, that is the proving of ancient documents, the testing of ancient documents. This is Friedrich Blass. We have it here. It's a big thing. I have a copy of my own, as a matter of fact. And Blass said, he gives the numbers of ways of which you can test the authenticity of an ancient document. And the obvious ones, get on the side here, but the most obvious are this. First, it can be a document like, say, Clement of Alexandria or Philo or someone like that, or any of the apostolic, or any of the the writers in the Patrologia, the fathers of the church. All they are is commentaries, like Science and Health. Other people are writing their Bibles and their commentaries and so forth, but they're just commentaries on the scriptures. They're sermons, they're wisdom literature and so forth. That's fine. Joseph Smith writes a history. Well, Blass says the one thing you cannot fake is a history. And the longer it gets, the more dangerous it gets exponentially. See, every time you add an item, you make it that many times more difficult to get away with something because you're tipping your hand if you're making it up. Very obvious. So a historical document is the hardest to fake, and a long historical document, he said, is impossible to fake. And this certainly is impossible here. So, but he says the best way of testing these, the second is not the broad sweeping ideas or the concept or romantic descriptions or things like that. But the little details of everyday life that slip in, the little casual things, and this chapter is loaded with them, the things that you never suspected that they sneak in on you. And those things that a person wouldn't have known, faked, and remember, nobody had been to Central America. There was no, at that time, there hadn't been any of the first people went there at all. It was terra incognita. Way back in the 1820s here, he's writing about it. We're going to see some of these things. But he says, like Samuel the Lamanite, they flatter the people. That's the best way to get the votes, he said. Sell people what they want to hear. Don't rebuke them what they want to hear. And that's, we like to hear that we're standing tall and all that sort of thing. And Moroni is fit to be tied, of course. He's the one that just got them through the war with, they got through by the skin of their teeth. You know, it's a very close thing. It was a long war. and they're finally exhausted, both sides are exhausted and sick of it, and then this guy starts stirring things up again. He starts going all over again. Well, you can imagine how Moroni would feel about that, because Moroni hated it. Remember, he was very young. He came out when he was 25 as a general, but he retired very early, too, after very few years. When the war was finally over, he retired to his own town, his own home, and died shortly after that. He didn't live very long. And he could have been dictator afterwards. He died easily. He was the hero. He was the man of the hour. And he was the great leader and so forth. Nope. He dropped all his offices, all his honors and so forth, and went and retired to private life. And that's the last we hear of him. Till he dies at a relatively young age. Well, but he's going to do something about it. He was angry with Amalekai. I should hope so. Now he does a remarkable. Now we start getting some of this stuff that couldn't be faked by anybody. He rent his coat, and I would leave my Arabic text home, wouldn't I? But this will have to do for the time being. He rent his coat, and he took a piece thereof, and he wrote upon it, "In memory of our God, our religion, our freedom, our peace, our wives, our children," and he fastened it upon the end of a pole. Now we have this coat, which is going to be used as a banner, called the Title of Liberty. And he talks about Christians. He uses all sorts of things that you think he may be giving himself away with. Now, how about this coat? Well, now we're going to have to refer to the battle scroll. We all know about the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's hard for me to realize that all the other students until now were contemporary with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But now that's 40 years behind us. Now, you don't all know. Dead Sea Scrolls aren't daily news anymore. In fact, they have been suppressed ever since 1960. Neither the Catholics nor the Protestants liked what they said. But I must tell you, well, we'll see why. We'll see why. I must tell you something about them in that case. I have this article yes, here it is. You know where they were discovered and all that. Well, in 1948, a shepherd boy by the name of Muhammad Dib, who was the nephew of the major domo in the house of President Barnes at the American University in Beirut, this all ties up. He was just a shepherd boy east of Jerusalem there, out in the desert, along the Dead Sea. Incidentally, that major domo was a very interesting person. And he was very much interested in the gospel, especially in the Pearl of Great Price. That's another story. These things all tie together. But he was chasing the sheep. You all know this. The sheep went into, this was cave number one. Was it number 11? No, it was number one. The cave went into, the sheep went into a cave. He threw a rock in to see where that would land in the cave. And instead of a clunk, he heard a clink. It hit something. It hit a jar. They went in and were all these jars stored there with documents in them, specially stored. And then they discovered 11 caves in quick order. They went out there gall excited. A big fight about what the documents were. They were buried there by some people that fled from Jerusalem at the time it was destroyed, after the time of Christ in the year 70. But before that, they went about 150 BC, they went out there, earlier than that. And then they discovered in a cave further down the Dead Sea, I suppose we should draw, people don't, these things as much as they do, well, a whole map, should I draw the map? Well, all right, this is the way it goes. This is Cyprus here, has nothing to do with it. But here is, the Jowf, here is the Great Rift, you see, and here is the Nile, goes along here, you see, and here's the Nile Delta, and here is Sinai, and here is the Dead Sea. Comes out here with a thing called the Lisan, or the tongue, which sticks out into it. It's very shallow here. You can walk across. They do. That's how they smuggle arms today into Palestine, by walking across here at night. They hold them on their heads, and there are paths across the way, but you must know the way. If you miss your step on either side, you're gone. Because it's twice as salty as the Great Salt Lake. It isn't just salt. It's not just brine. It's acid. It just eats your head off if you get into it. Well, though they do swim here at Ain Gedi, there's a deep canyon looking very much like Rock Canyon, very steep, very dangerous cliffs and so forth. And on that cliffs are a number of caves and holes. And that's the cave of manuscripts was found there in 1965, 66, wasn't it? Yadin and his group found it there. The Arabs have been known about these things all along, but this one is the cave of manuscripts, and but the original was, of course, at Qumran. You all know about Qumran here, and this is where in 1948 where the cave was, and they find other caves, and everybody went out, and here's Jerusalem right down here. You see, it's not very far. Here's Jericho, just about 2 miles above. Jericho is here, and Jericho and Jer and Jer are there, you see. There's Jerusalem. Just a couple of miles on the highway now, they've paved it, goes down there, goes all along here, and then zigzags up here and gets back to Haran. And that very graphic map will tell you exactly what's going on here. But down along the, they found these manuscripts. They've been, well, what I'm going to tell you about this one, at Ein Gedi, the cave there, Nahal Haver, they found that, or where they found the Cave of Scrolls. There they found the people who had been fleeing to these caves and hiding way back since the earliest days of the Egyptians, when the Egyptians came in way back in the first dynasty. 3000 BC, they started depositing stuff, family goods, records, and things like that in these caves. They'd have to come back. They deposited some marvelous temple implements were deposited in the cave at Ein Gedi there, and they, along with these documents. And what they find is deeds, wills of farms, and so forth. And here, one thing leads to another. This all belongs last semester. We have to know about this here because we're talking about here the battle scroll that came from this. One of these scrolls was describing how Israel should go to battle in the last days and in their days. The sacred order given to them with the law, which we don't have in the Old Testament. See, what is the sacred order of battle they have to use? And very important are these banners that talk about their liberties and their families. They figure in the regular order of battle, and this plays a very important role here. Now, they were edited by Professor Yadin. Professor Yadin has been here several times. He just died. He was the one who took command in the 8 Days War, the liberation of Israel, 1948. And he visited us a number of times here. He was telling a group of us one night that this battle scroll was discovered just before the battle, the liberation of Israel. The first battle, when they had to fight nothing, that miraculous war, when they finally got a foot in the Holy Land, when the Arabs were going to sweep in and wipe right out, they discovered this, and he said, this was a great inspiration, because this is an inspiration to the liberating of the land, and they raised the title of liberty and all that sort of thing. It had a great influence on them. And he told some remarkable stories. He was chief commander. He not only is the head of antiquities in Israel, I say he recently died, but he was also commander of the army at that time. He told about a furious argument he had with Ben-Gurion, because where should they deploy their artillery? On the Golan Heights to stop the Syrians up there, which are very dangerous, or should they keep them back in Jerusalem to defend the city? So they decided to split there, after much argument, they decided to split their artillery and put half of it in the Golan Heights and half of it in Jerusalem. The entire artillery consisted of two guns, old brass 75 Skoda guns from World War I. That was their entire artillery. And with that, they saved the nation. Believe it or not, this is the way things happen. Miraculous. He said, Yadin says, we don't believe in miracles, but we count on them. typical Jewish joke, you know, and typical Israeli attitude. But they put the one at the Golan Heights and the one in Jerusalem. And The Syrians lost a tank attack, and the one gun let go, the only one they had, and bam, it hit a tank. And it was completely surprising. They didn't have any artillery at all. Then it shot again and hit another. They said, hey, they must have heavy artillery. And they stopped the attack. They drew back then, and that saved Israel. These things, as close as all that, you know, just one little feeble old 75 gun was all it took to do it, to promise other things like the Lord. Filling the people with panic, but down in Mexico and so forth, and Johnson's army. These things do that way. The Lord says, I'll fight your battles, and he does. But anyway, we have this battle scroll, and it's interesting because of all this talk it has about the scrolls, and it goes on. Well, let's read the rest of it. Here he rent his coat, and he took a piece thereof and wrote upon it, in memory of our religion, our freedom, our peace, and our wives, and our children. He fastened on a head plate and his breastplate. Notice he puts on his ceremonial armor. Notice his extra armor. He put shields in the plural and girded on his armor about his loins. He's really heavily armed on. And then he took the pole and he read it the title of liberty. He bowed himself down and he dedicated it, the land to the Christians. Well, I guess we better take it as we go verse to verse here. And so here let's refer to what goes on here. No, I say we're going to first take the banner of Kaveh. The background here of the liberation of the people by the man with the banner, because the idea of it being his coat, because immediately we think of the coat of Kaveh. Excuse me. You see, the freeing of Israel They closely connected with the name of Cyrus, who was their great deliverer. It was Cyrus who brought them back from the Babylonian captivity after the days of Lehi here, after they'd been there a while. They brought them back, 70 years, and they were ready to come back, and Cyrus brought them back. And they always had, they're very close to Persia, as you know, the ancient Persian Empire, the book of Esther. Esther was the right hand of the Shah there. And so we have the story of Kaveh, and we summarized it here in this approach to the Book of Mormon. There's some interesting material in here, I noticed, and part of it is the story of the Banner of Kaveh. 4916, well, 184. So we wrote it down here to save us some trouble. I was going to bring on the later stuff, the fuller stuff, the Arabic stuff. I had it all home, but I'll bring it next time, that's all right. This is like the Roman Fecialis and so forth, yes. Now, we talk about the very close association here in Jewish eschatology, in the Jewish books and the Talmud and so forth, because after all, that book I was going to bring, after all, what happened when Jerusalem fell in the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the people all, it was destroyed, absolutely smashed, the people scattered, as it tells us, 25th chapter of Matthew was going to be, and even best in the Pearl of Great Price, the section in Joseph Smith. But they're going to, where do they go? Where did they flee? Most of them fled to the Persian Empire. And they settled there. Persia gave them shelter for hundreds of years. And so the most important old settlements of the Jews were around Persia. And I have a collection of the documents that were collected there by an investigator who went around and interviewed. He interviewed Jews all over in the Persian Empire at that time and got old stories about them and so forth. But one of the stories that was favorite was the story of Kaveh, and this is what it is. The title episode, A Clear and Independent Parallel for Mormon's Banner, is just like the flag of Kaveh, the Derif Shah Kaveh Yani here. He was the legendary founder of the Magi. The Magi, now we're already into Hermetic literature here with the Magi, the same Magi that came from Persia to give gifts to the Lord because they'd seen his star in the east, and so they'd seen his star rising. There were astrologers, you see, they'd seen his star. And they play a very important part. They play a very important part in the Kabbalah. They play a important part all in Jewish mysticism, all the way through. They're always popping up. And here, these were the Magi, and this is the founder of the Magi, not of the Persian nation, but of the sect of the holy men who study the cosmos and make predictions and live strictly moral lives and so forth in communities of the saints. But these are the Magi. And it says, Iran, in the beginning of the story, Iran was under the rule of the serpent, the oppressor, the man of the lie, the king of madmen, Dahak, it means the liar, the deceiver. Dahak, he ruled the nation, the man of the lie, the Dregvant, the king of madmen, who reigned 1,000 years and forced all men to subscribe their names in the book of the dragon. That's an interesting thing because, see, Nephi, Moroni here, requires all the people that come under his banner to subscribe their names. And the same thing happens, of course, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Battle Scroll, as we'll see. See, we're dealing with one particular episode, with one particular phase of a culture in which you have a rather complicated, rather exotic way of doing things, and the Book of Mormon just matches up to perfection here. And to liberate the people, there arose up in Isfahan a mighty man, a blacksmith named Kaveh. I'll put his name down here. This is Kaveh. This is the story of Kaveh. Oops, oh boy. What does that do to you? The story of Kaveh, and he took a leather apron. He took his leather apron, just to remember, Moroni rent his own garment and put it on a pole, and that's exactly what Kaveh does. He puts his garment, he takes his leather garment, and he puts it on a pole. The leather garment he wore at his work, and he placed it on the end of a pole. This became the symbol of liberation, remained for many centuries the national banner, as well as the sacred emblem of the Magi. Going about with his banner, he waved it everywhere. Kaveh called upon the people to rise in revolt. We're told here the people came, 22 verse, and the people came running together with their armor girded about their loins, rending their garments in token and so forth. The same thing as the way they came to join Kaveh here. So what you're going through, it's a ritualized thing. Remember, ancient society is sacral. Everything they do is a rite, is an ordinance. You go out to war, it's an ordinance. You come back, it's an ordinance. Because everything we do is an ordinance, I see. When It's ritualized, and we don't hold it sacred necessarily, but say a football game. We follow rules and ordinances and colors and procedures, everything as if it had been orchestrated since the year one. This elaborate rite of a football game, which is a rite, I see. It's a symbolic, one side, one color against the other color, and the one that gets the most points and so forth. All these people come and sit around and look at it and take the sides, and they cheer together in unison. All this was well established by the Romans when they had the factiones and the same colors and things like you cheer for your party and the like. Well, this is very ancient. This goes way back, you see, and we have it going back here, this sort of thing. Going about with his banner, he called upon the people to rise in revolt and shake off the oppressor. To lead the people, the hero Thraitaona, our friend Moroni, was raised up in the mountains by a shepherd. Well, that's what happened to Cyprus. Cyrus was raised up in the mountains by a shepherd. He put Cave in charge of raising and leading an army. Now, this Thraitaona is a doublet of King Cyrus, the founder of the Persian nation, and in Jewish lore, the holiest kings next to Solomon and David. So they're very close to these customs and things. They regarded Cyrus. The holy kings go Solomon, David, and Cyrus. So the parallel with the story of Moroni's banner is very striking here. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls provide the link here. We've got Cave and his banner going and so forth. So what do we have here? Well, but more about the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're the best control we have on the Book of Mormon, because here are the Jews doing things as they did back there, and it matches the Book of Mormon in so many points. Now, as early as 1960, John Allegro, who had been very active in the Scrolls, lost his job at Oxford for writing an article, which was published in The Atlantic, showing that between 1950 and 1960, the Scrolls had been suppressed. They'd been definitely suppressed. We had Father Fitzmyer, Joseph Fitzmyer, gave a course in Aramaic, in Aramaic here, one summer, about 10 years ago, yes. There were a few of us, four or five of us in the course, he was giving Aramaic, but he is the foremost Roman Catholic Scrolls man in the country, and we asked him about the Scrolls. Well, here, Father DeVoe was the one who was in charge of the Catholic, Scrolls over there. I mean, of editing, they divided it up under the Rockefeller grant. They divided up Catholics would have some, Baptists would have some, Presbyterians and so forth. And he said, make a long story short, Father Fitzmyer insisted at that time that not 5% of the Scrolls had been published. They've all been kept back. Because the Christians are worried sick about them, they're much too Jewish. And the Jews are worried sick about them, they're much too Christian. But what they are is Book of Mormon. We're talking this now. Now, this article by Norman Gold is a good one. It came out in 1987, The Sciences. Norman Gold teaches Hebrew at Hebrew University. And he's taken these scrollers to task. The way they could avoid being serious about it, the way they could avoid having to explain the scrolls about it, they said, well, they're just Essene. The Essenes were a group of crackpots that lived out there because Josephus mentioned some of them living on the Dead Sea, some of them lived in Egypt and so forth. And everybody said, they started out saying they were Essenes. Certain DuPont and others said they were. And they argued about that. And they finally concluded the best argument was say they are Essenes. We'll say the Essenes wrote these and we don't have anything to worry about because they were just crackpot. We don't have to explain this. But it isn't that way at all. As Norman Gold shows, they're not Essene a bit. That isn't what it is. And he makes these points here. He talks about the Essene fervor, and everybody takes it for that now. But he says, what they are not told is that the Essene Qumran theory, however widely accepted, is at odds with almost every shred of evidence. Analysis of the scrolls actually reveals that Judaism as a whole was a salient influence. This represents the religion of the Jews before the fall of the temple. See, with the fall of the temple, these things we have to remember too, The synagogues, the schools of the rabbis, didn't begin until the temple disappeared. See, the Jews, a rabbi is not a priest. He has no authority. He's just a learned man who's been chosen by a community. And they're very jealous of the temple. And when the temple was taken away, that order went away. And then the synagogue became the important thing. Well, they'd used it before. And so we have the Jews here with the... that they'd given up with when they lost the temple, they lost everything as far as that goes. An entirely new order of Judaism was established. Before then, their practices were different, their doctrines were different, everything else was different. See, the Book of Mormon is still the temple-centered Judaism, and you'll notice The first thing they do when they land in the new world that Nephi does when he goes off and founds his community, he makes a model of the temple. They build a temple, and of course the people throughout the Book of Mormon are temple building people. Well, they came just under the wire, because after that the temple was destroyed. Then came the second house. But the Temple of Solomon was still standing in Lehi's day. But it wasn't standing in Nephi's day. It was destroyed in Nephi's day. After they left, Jerusalem was destroyed, and especially it was the temple that got sought. And so here we have another kind of Judaism entirely, which sounds an awful lot like Christianity. It keeps mixing them. So that's why nobody likes it. Say, well, blame the Essenes for that. They were a mystic group and so forth. But he says, that won't do. This is the Judaism that was practiced by all the Jews before the fall of the temple. That's why it is, and that's why it finds so strange to you. And so he tells us here, he says, we widely accept the Essenes as having a great effect on the formation of Christianity here. And then he goes on. Well, the cemeteries at Kirbet Qumran were the graves of women as well as men. Unqualified sexual absence they didn't have. Because they were told the ancient records of the Essenes, they were celibate, but the people at Qumran weren't celibate. It took an awful time to bring these people to realize this. During the war, I was back there in 1964, and there was not a soul there. I was sent back by the brethren to get something. And Joseph Saad was the only person in the Rockefeller Museum, the big museum, the Palestine Museum it's called now. And he was in charge of the whole operation. He coordinated the whole operation, Joseph Saad did. And he was the only one there. We got to be very good friends. He took me out to Qumran. We spent several days out there going around. He recalling all the things that happened there, the arguments. They couldn't agree on anything they found. The interesting thing was there were all these baptismal fonts. They're very obviously baptismal fonts. And immediately, the Christians all declared, these were just pools for tanning leather. That's all that was. It had nothing to do with... They almost panicked when they saw these Jews having baptismal fonts there. And they... We went back later with a group, and the Jews had taken over at that time, and they'd rearranged everything. They put big signs up there and said, these were baptismal fonts. This is where they baptized. And this made such an impression on one member of the group that he joined the church. That's a non sequitur, but it's true. the idea, these were actually baptismal fonts. This was a community. But what were they doing out there? Well, there were all sorts of people. It's a long story, but you can't do anything serious with the Book of Mormon without bringing them up here. Now, the Essene monks' father. The Father DeVoe said the Essenes must have lived in caves, but what we find is administrative headquarter buildings. You know, Father DeVoe had his opinion about things. You all seen pictures of Cave 4, the one where the point comes out and it has the caves along the side like this. You know, you see the pictures. This one, it's this marly... material looks like the Morrison deposit here, about the same color and so forth. It has these caves in it. That's Cave 4, where they found so many caves. Well, we were going all through Cave 4, and they had up in the chinks everywhere, there was these documents were stuffed all over the place. It was marvelous. They had them lined up in jars and like, there's a whole library here. And it was when the work was all over. They were all packing up to go home. They just discovered three caves. They were through. Father DeVoe said, there's nothing left here. There's not any more. And an Arab boy, curiously, scrambled down the side here and went into one of these caves and started walking around back and came and reported this Cave 4 that they had discovered. Oh, he said, he never saw anyone so mad in his life as Father DeVoe. He said he thought he would die of apoplexy because this guy had discovered a new cave when it should have been all over with. In the same way, they discover, he talks about here, about the refectory, the place where they ate. And there was sort of dumb waiter there. There's a place, a hole in the wall, where they serve food through here. And they couldn't figure out what that was at all. And the experts couldn't. And the Arabs from nearby who were excavating, the people working on it, said, we know what this is. This is what they do at all, the palaces and so forth. When a meal is being prepared, you never should smell the food until the banquet comes. And then the women come in bringing the grub in, the roasts and all the vegetables and it all... the good smell, and then they come in going, la, 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 and everybody shouts because it's the food and everybody smells it. But it's a bad sign if you smell the food before your banquet. You don't. You come. So it's cooked in a cookhouse outside, and then it's brought in. Here they served it through the dumb waiter because this was a community of some sort, they say. And again, Our experts were all nonplussed because the Arab, the ignorant peasants who were digging for them, knew a lot more about the place than they did. And this came out all the way through. These people, yeah, we know how they do this. We've been doing this ourselves all the time. But he goes on here. But the point to this is that out here in Qumran, we have, well, how many documents are there now? There are quite a list of documents, but over 10,000 fragments have been discovered, of course. But every book of the Bible except Esther is represented there. We have all sorts of writings, including the most valuable ones. We won't go into them. But they're necessary here because they do have, among the important ones discovered in Cave 1, is IQM. This is where they always note them. See, this is number 1, Roman num, Q, Qumran. Cave number 1, Qumran. Milchama, battle scroll. That's Hebrew word for battle. It's the Milchama scroll from the first cave. And this tells about the order of battle. It's worth a whole book, you see, telling about how these people go to battle and how they raise the banner and what they prescribe on the banner and how the leader takes over and so forth. We'll see that in a minute. Talks about the scripture. I don't want to get held back on these. There were 500 to 800 extremely diverse texts in the Qumran caves. 500 to 800 extremely diverse texts were found there. Not just fragments, but texts. Because there are thousands of texts, of course. And the scrolls derived not from an author's workshop, as they've always told us, but from one or more large libraries. And since no evidence of a library has ever been found at Kirbet Qumran, where did they come from? It seems these people all came from Jerusalem and so forth. A large and heterogeneous body of literature. Let me go down here. This is important. In 1952, the copper scroll was discovered in Cave Free. Now, this is an interesting thing. Where did they have their treasures buried? What was the most valuable of all? That would be the book that registered where all these things were to be buried and hid, where you to find them. But they put that on bronze plates, on brass plates, so that it wouldn't perish. See? And they had plates so big, riveted together like that with three holes for rivets in them. They're riveted together. But they plastered them together side by side and then rolled them into a copper roll, copper scroll. And it took years to solve how they'd get that unrolled. They didn't unroll it. They finally had to saw it into strips in order to read it. But the interesting thing, it turns out to contain the record of where all the other scrolls are found. And actually, the most valuable one is going to be kept on metal, like the bronze plates or the gold plates in the Book of Mormon, gold being rather expensive. But about the same size, thickness, and so forth. And the copper scroll was a letter associated with documentary autographs. Now, it was written by people, by the person himself, and it, we're told elsewhere, Allegro I talked about, who edited the copper scroll. And he says he sees how the people get tired writing in it, personal writings and so forth. Their hands get tired, they slow down, the figures get more careless, exactly as you read in the Book of Mormon, where the writers say, if we could write more, but our hands are not up to it and so forth, we could write more if we could write Hebrew and the like. And they complain about the difficulty of writing on the plates, and these people do the same thing. They're writing on plates here. And he says, the copper scroll has been executed not in a scribe's elegant book hand, but in the relatively crude and haphazard style associated with documentary autographs. The persons themselves are writing in it. It's not a professional scribe. This is what you write in and make your own contribution in the Book of Mormon. It includes the various prized artifacts, including written documents. This tells you where to find the other documents. They've been sequestered at burial sites throughout the Judean wilderness. They've scattered them everywhere. Many hiding places are located in the wadis, eastward and southward from Jerusalem. The next scribe caches near Jericho, for example, where books were indeed discovered during the 3rd and 9th century. I wrote an article in the Revue de Qumran on this, showing that the Arabs were constantly discovering these in the early centuries of Islam. They mention a number of such caves where documents were hidden. They're lost now. We don't know anything about them, but they talk about these caves. And they're mystified by the people who lived there and who left them there. And there was a very important community called Rakim, a few miles south of Amman. I went out there with Ani Dijani, who was the head of he was the cousin of the king of Jordan, and he was the head of archaeology in the country. And we spent some time out there, and I was surprised when I went back the next time, years afterwards, to find that there was a big monument to Ani Dijani there in front of it, telling the work that he'd done and so forth. But it's now converted into a sacred shrine, the Shrine of the Seven Sleepers. They're erecting a monstrous mosque there, a reinforced concrete mosque. It's going to become a pilgrimage shrine in the center. It just started out with that little typical Qumran. I had suspicion there's another Qumran out there at Rakim, and we went down, and it sure enough was, but they got into all sorts of trouble. Both Amni Dajani and his brother Rafiq Dajani were murdered. All sorts of things happened. They play rough back there. So what it describes is the widespread sequestration of books and valuable artifacts at sites scattered throughout the Judean wilderness in a pattern radiating not from Qumran but from Jerusalem. These were Jews fleeing at that time everywhere. And I say way back here they had been doing this thing since 3000 BC. Every time there was danger they'd flee to these caves. And remember, the Lord tells them, in that day, flee to the mountains and don't come back. You see, he tells you flee to the mountains. That's what they'd always done when the enemy came in. And so we find more scrolls way down south here at Masada, way down at the south end that we so vividly depicted it there. And so the moral of all this is that, yes, Christian ideas we find here, predestined and election, the duality of the flesh and the spirit, darkness and light, falsehood and truth, evolved out of Judaism as a whole. Judaism and Christianity ceased to be distant, because of the scrolls, he says. Judaism and Christianity ceased to be distant theological cousins and become much closer relatives. And that disturbed both of them. See, the Jews had found it much too Christian. For example, it talks about a meeting of they have to organize at Qumran in a meeting with a presidency of three and a council of 12. And whenever they meet, they're supposed to have the sacrament, the bread and the wine, which shall anticipate the coming of the Messiah. Well, this is Christian. This isn't Jewish, you see. It shouldn't be here 150 years before, but there it is, you see, and it's Book of Mormon, too. And then the Christians don't like it at all because these people were Jews stealing their thunder. The Catholics say they've robbed Christianity of its originality. Christianity isn't original in the Book of Mormon. It's always been chosen from the very beginning. The gospel's always been there. So we find these two things running right together. And notice, this is so important for our 46th verse here because it starts using the word Christian all over the place here. You see, they took the name Christians. They possessed the land for Christ. Well, what would they call themselves then, if you want to anticipate? Well, they'd call themselves Masihiyah. And we'll get to that in a minute here, because, well, right here now. The name's Christ and Christian in the 13th and 16th verse. Well, in Hebrew and Arabic, they're Masihiyum, but the Jews won't use that word today because Christ means the anointed one, and Masa is to anoint, and the Messiah, means the anointed, means exactly the same thing as Christ, see? And like the Muslims, they don't use the word Christ, they use the word Messiah, and they don't use the word Christian, they word Masihiyum, the Messiah people. So these people, when they use the word in the Book of Mormon, use the word Messiah, but Christ means the same thing, you see, as far as that goes. And then, but the Hebrew, it's a very interesting thing. Modern Hebrew avoids that. They won't use that word Messiah because it's making a concession here. They call them the Notzari. The Notzari, that's the Nazareans. It's safe to call them Nazareans, you see. But if you start calling Christians Mashiach, as the Arabs do, that means, we're in real trouble here. We're admitting that they believe in the Messiah, they're coming, the anointed one, and so forth, which we believe in, too, as far as that goes. Now, it's an interesting thing, as long as we're talking about. I'm going to tell you another series of connected stories. When I first went down to the Hopis in the 40s with Brother Virgil Bushman, who'd lived his life among them, they're renewing the Hopi mission among the Hopis down there, which are, as you know, the oldest civilization settled in America. And the Southwest Indians, they're Pueblo Indians, and they've lived in their cities for well over 1,000 years there. And old Tom Kuyushva there, who was the first member who rejoined the church. It's a very interesting thing. Brother Bushman went down and gave a sermon on the Book of Mormon, and after it, Tom, who was the grand old man, he was the leader. It's in Hota Villa there. It's the most pious of the communities. They have 5 kivas, and he is the one that's always dressed with the ceremonial turquoise and so forth, always with the proper kliya there, the knots and all the rest of it, and always had the place of honor at the dances and so forth. And he was at the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, he came up and said, Brother Bushman, you want to be baptized. He had no word of English. He spoke, he wanted to be baptized. And Brother Bushman says, but you don't know anything about it. You just heard it. He says, but I know it's true. I know it's true in here. So he did become an elder, and he did become very important. And he told the story when I went back later with Brother Bushman. He told the story of how the Hopis settled there. They came up from the south. See, the great red city of the south was destroyed because they were wicked people and they killed the prophets. The people migrated at that time. They came up from the great red city of the south that was destroyed. There's much saying about that. And when they came up, they came to first Mesa there, the oldest Mesa, that's Old Araby. And coming up the Mesa, it was the springtime, a beautiful period. And the grass was green and waving in the wind. And it was a beautiful spring day, which you don't often get there. And the leader walked out up the hill, and as they saw a tall, handsome man standing at the ridge of the hill, at the top of the hill, and he went up to him, and he said, "Who are you?" He said, "I am Mashovi." The two names they're giving is Mashal, Messiah, and Mashovi, the two names. He says, "I am Mashovi, and I rule all this land that you can see. It all belongs to me as far as you can see. If you want to settle here, you must pay tithes to me." And the leader put up his hand for the nakwatch, that's the sacred grip, to identify himself. And the tall, handsome, strange man put out his hand, and the leader gave a strong jerk on it, and he pulled off his mask. Remember, the people always remember masks for ceremonies. Pulled off his mask, and it was a death head. It was Satan, masquerading as the Messiah, you see. It was a fake. But nevertheless, they still continue to pay their tithes to him. And because, after all, he is the ruler of this world. He is the one who possesses the land. And the 10%, they'll pay their tithes in the church, but they will also pay their 10% to Mashovi. Now, the interesting thing is the same story is told in Fatlabi, whom I failed to bring today, about when David went up to the Mount of the Temple in Jerusalem. He wanted to build a temple there. He was met by the tall, handsome stranger, who was Satan, and he had to have the fight with him and so forth. It's a very interesting thing, the way these tie up, but this name Messiah, see, that's the name they would use for Christ. The Messiahians, the Christians, and that's what they call themselves, and of course in our language, it's Christian, is what it is. And so, we have here then, Moroni, in 14 and 13, consecrates the title of liberty, it says. Liberty is Daror, Kherut. Now, we're talking about that again. This may sound like modern American language, something Joseph Smith was just lifting, but don't fool yourself, you see. After all, what is the inscription on the Liberty Bell? Proclaim liberty throughout the land. Where does that come from? That comes from Leviticus, doesn't it? Yes, yes, Leviticus. Leviticus 25 I have down here. That's Bible. That's Old Testament. That's a Jewish. Proclaiming liberty throughout the land. They're just following the procedures since the days of Moses, as far as we're concerned here. So, under the law of Moses, liberty was the name of the game. See, they alone, of all people, the Jews held the Jubilee. Remember, every seventh year, and then every seven times seventh year, 50th year, all debts were canceled. All debts, all slaves were freed. Everything was wiped out. No other people had. Now, that was liberty. That was Kherut. Because as long as we're in debt to each other, as long as we're under contract to each other, as long as we have to pay off each other, we're not in true liberty. But they knew what real liberty was, and the Lord gave them that command, that every seventh year, every slave should be freed, should be let go, and not just let go. He should be provided for well for the rest of his life. You have to take good care of him. All these sort of things, all debts would be considered paid off. Because I say, as long as we're in debt to each other, we can't say anybody's free in particular. So the Jews knew what freedom was. They knew what Kherut was, and they talk about it all the time here. Well, Moroni then, the titles on the banners of the, well, the time is up. The titles on the banners are very interesting. We have them listed. There are quite a few of them. They always talk about these idealistic things, like, just quickly here, page 14 and so forth, what he has to say about it. What Professor Yadin has to say about it. We're fortunate to have Yadin visit us here personally so many times and be so confidential. We do have the Jews visit us from Jerusalem. We visit them too a lot, as you know. We have a Jerusalem Center there and so forth. And the titles, a very interesting thing, are mainly based, as Yadin points out here, on apocalyptic, eschatological, and pseudographic parts of the Bible. Those prophets, in general, and especially Isaiah, who of course is the favorite in the Book of Mormon, as he is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And he says, great equality is influenced here, and the influence of apocalyptic and pseudographic, that means this borderline literature that goes back to the Jews that was lost and has just been found through the 19th and 20th centuries and so forth. This we would call, this Dead Sea Scroll stuff, you would call pseudepigraphic. For example, the Battle of the Sons of Light. This is called the Battle of the Sons of Light and Darkness. That's the title that's given to this, to those who found it, though the title page was missing. But he says what we find on the banners, things like this. Names and positions of Michael, the light and darkness, the angels of the ancient world. Then they talk about the day of God, the place of knowledge, of justice and truth. Finally, the calendar. Notice knowledge, justice, and truth. And they enroll by families. Everybody who enrolls under a banner has to sign his name, exactly as they do here in the Book of Mormon. And where he says they had all who was... they came running and covenanted it in commandments and rent their garments. And then he says when they were commanded... Oh, well, we'll get to that anyway, but I see the time is up now. But these things are... There's so much of it, and it's so condensed. And to put it in a proper order, it's more than I can do.